Sometimes you might feel trapped between the right and the left. No one listens when you say taxation is theft.
I never got to film the raccoon.
But there's a place where people know harsh government brings tears.
Fuck the podcast.
So grab some blue and adrenochrome. Let's make the time.
Okay, all right, here we go.
Friends against government.
Because have you ever seen a squirrel just kind of do its thing?
I don't know what that means, man.
Friends against government. They're your friends.
Austin, why don't you give us a little bit of background on what you're doing? I heard you on Pete Quinonez's show. I think I butchered his name. Goddamn. I heard you on his. It is. It's so hard. I think that's the first time I've actually tried to say it on a podcast, and I've been dreading that day. So sorry, Pete. But I heard you on his show. It was really interesting shit that you're doing. And so I wanted to bring you on and give our listeners, whichever ones that aren't listening to Pete, I can't imagine there are too many, an intro to what you're doing, because I've done a lot of shows with like the 3D printing crowd. Like Control Pew and Lee, NBlock Press and folks like that. So, why don't you give us like a little bit of background on what you're doing and all that.
Okay. So our big project right now is the Dagny Dagger, of course, named after Dagny Taggart of Atlas Shrugged. That is also where our company name comes from. The Dagny Dagger is a new type of bullet, that we are developing as, you know, a full cartridge of fixed ammunition that is easily able to penetrate body armor, especially pistol-rated body armor, but does not conform to the federal government's definition of quote-unquote armor-piercing ammunition. It does this by a novel design for a projectile, and also the use of materials that are not included in the definition of armor-piercing ammunition. So in addition to just kind of skirting by the technical definition, we have also invented a projectile type that we call armor-penetrating hollow point that is even more effective in penetrating body armor than traditional AP ammo. We've got some other projects going on that are also exciting that we can talk about if you'd like.
Oh yeah.
But that's the big thing going on right now. And we recently released a demo video demonstrating, how effective it is at penetrating armor and also how effective it is, at wounding ballistics gel. So.
Cool.
People can go watch that if they'd like.
I tell you what, why don't we do this? I'm just going to recommend that everybody who's interested in that project, and we'll talk about it a little bit more in this show, but anybody who's interested in the Dagny Dagger, go listen to Pete's show with you. That would have been, I don't know, what, like a week or two ago? It probably came out last week, so early October?
Several days ago.
Yeah, okay. So early to mid-October 2020, go back and listen to that show. If you want the more technical guns, details on the Dagny Dagger, and let's just pretend that people have listened to that. And then that way that can free us up to explore some of your other projects and maybe some of the other aspects of the dagger that you didn't get to get into on Pete's show. Cause I mean, podcast time is a little bit limited, but, so why don't we do that? I do have one question for you. And this is a question that I always have, even for the 3D printing guys, and it's not at all an attack. It's a strategic question. Is what is your perception of the threat of the regulations simply changing? And like for instance, we all know that the lower receiver is the regulated gun component, and you know they're 3D printing that to get around the need to register for a purchase of a lower receiver, of a rifle or a pistol. And now obviously they've got the FGC, Mark II, that I think you can basically almost build entirely in your home. So you don't have to purchase any other components, or not many other components. But what is your perceived threat in terms of just regulatory change that may take, you know, kind of kneecap the legality of what you're doing?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, and it's kind of a little bit more complex. It's definitely different from what I would say that we are part of the militia industrial complex, along with the other, those 3D printed gun guys. And the challenges we face in ammunition and in kind of developing this altogether new technology are a little bit different. Number one, armor-piercing ammunition is an issue that everybody kind of forgot about back in the 80s when that legislation was passed. It was supposed to be just a blanket ban on the stuff. So it hasn't been the cause du jour that regulating the firearms themselves have been and continues to be what those guys kind of face. And then, of course, as we see, like, you know, the whole ATF debacle right now with pistol braces versus stocks and that kind of thing.
Yeah, when did that exactly come around? Because that's the issue of the short barrel rifle, right? The SBR, where if you have a rifle barrel shorter than 12 inches or 12 inches and down or something.
Yeah, so then, you know, you can't have a short barrel rifle. So what they do is they just take the stock off of it, which makes it not a short barrel rifle, and put on what's called a pistol brace.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's used as a stock. That's just the fact of the matter. But it wasn't intended that way when it was invented. So the ATF had kind of allowed that to slide. I think kind of anybody that's realistic about it kind of fully expected at some point the ATF to revisit that decision. And that's because, like, again, it's so subjective. Like, most of the time that the firearms industry tries to skirt the law, it's like, we're going to make something that's a stock, but not actually a stock, mm-hmm. or something like that. But again, you know, what we're doing with the Dagger is different. So not only are we kind of flying under the radar because AP ammo isn't, you know, it's not on the agenda of gun control organizations. It's not an issue that they've really thought about in three decades.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, there's a list of prohibited materials to use in handgun ammunition that is what defines armor-piercing ammunition. It is really difficult to define, for instance, a material that doesn't contain copper, doesn't contain iron. You can't define that as copper or steel,
right?
Or as brass or steel. It's just, you know, objectively outside the definition. There's no subjectivity the way there is with other stuff, you know, like the pistol brace stuff. So it would take a new act of Congress to add to that legislation to ban what we're doing, or, you know, just, you know, follow some other framework to ban the ammunition that we've invented. And as I like to say, you know, what does that look like? Well, it looks like a team of, you know, six-figure paid lawyers that work for a particular legislator doing, you know, months of research, trying to get familiar with firearms technology that they don't have no idea about. And of course, there's no way the system could understand it like we do as mm-hmm. the creators, as engineers. And then so that legislator introduces legislation to a committee. And, you know, it takes forever for that to actually get around to being discussed by a committee. They argue about it for a long time. And maybe then they pass some version of legislation onto, say, the House floor. And the House then debates it for who knows how long. Again, these are, like, supposed to be the most powerful people in the world, the rulers of the United States of America. And they make changes to it, and they finally pass it, and it goes to the Senate. The Senate doesn't like it. They send it back to the House. The House makes changes, sends it back to the Senate. The Senate finally passes. It goes to, you know, like, the President of the United States of America to sign into law. He does, and directs the ATF to start enforcing this new ban. And they send us, Atlas Arms, a letter that says, you better stop what you're doing. And then a month later, we come out with, you know, the next wave, we're going to bypass the regulation.
Right, yeah.
So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't think it looks really good. Gun control is really unpopular right now, especially as, like, you know, Arizona, where I live, is a battleground state. I'm getting political flyers from, like, every town for gun control and Moms Demand Action, you know, trying, you know, speaking on favor of their gun control candidates. The flyers don't even mention gun control as an issue because gun control is so unpopular right now.
Right.
So yeah. I feel pretty safe about it. I mean, our company has taken great pains to ensure the best long-term strategy to keep this stuff legal. But, you know, we're flying under the radar, and for a variety of reasons, we don't face the danger that those other guys do.
Hmm. Okay. Okay. So, well, I mean, I think that's kind of the safe haven that a lot of people in this new kind of like peer to peer 3D printing world and so like homemade firearm world, that's the safe haven is almost that you're up against this incredibly slow, you know, potentially very violent, but very slow bureaucracy that where you can essentially hide behind its own size. Like, you know, I mean, you're just so nimble in what you're able to do. So go into a little bit. I do want to hear at least a little bit of a breakdown of what the Dagny Dagger is in itself.
Okay. So like technically speaking, the Dagny Dagger is a two-part bullet. It is composed of a core and a jacket. The core is essentially a sharpened stud of an exotic alloy that unfortunately we can't talk about right now because of that that legal prudence and strategy.
Okay.
But people will know about it when we do release the project open source. And then it is surrounded by a jacket that is composed of a polymer. And those two are bonded together. A lot of people say it's a sabo. It is not. That is a bonded jacket. It functions as a jacket, just like you would expect from a copper jacket. The bullet in its design, as I mentioned, it's an armor penetrating hollow point, APHP, as we call it. When you shoot an armored target, that jacket is sheared off. It kind of, it's sloughed off. And mm-hmm. The core is what continues to penetrate through the armor and into the target. When you shoot an unarmored target, like ballistics gel, or God forbid, like an unarmored intruder or something, the core goes straight through, but that jacket, it mushrooms off of, it is kind of like peeled off of that core, and it mushrooms, forming a massive expanded projectile like you would see from a hollow point. Mm-hmm. But of course, much more expanded than a traditional hollow point. And it causes much, much more severe wounding than a traditional hollow point. So not only is it armor penetrating, but in fact, it is superior expanding ammunition in place of typical defense ammo that you would usually carry or use for home defense.
And is the intent for these to be homemade, or what is the ultimate intent from y'all's standpoint on this?
Definitely so. We do plan on producing these projectiles commercially, but the number one intention was always to be open sourced. And we are a nonprofit research company. The number one goal for us is to tell people how this is made, tell people how to make it, and then give them the tools that are required for them to make it themselves at home, regardless of commercial availability or what these silly people that claim to rule us might have to say about it.
Awesome. Awesome. So what is your vision of the tooling and the materials needed for the average person to be able to do this down the road?
So right now, the turnkey solution that we are looking forward to developing is in two parts. One of those parts is a Ghost Gunner, which is, of course, you know, this open source mill. Fits on a desktop and allows you to easily do work, finishing 80%, customizing lower receivers and pistol frames and that kind of thing. And we will be adding lathe capability to it. So right now it's a mill. We're going to make it into a lathe by adding an add-on that we plan on producing. And that'll essentially allow you to produce the core of the Dagny Dagger just like you would finish an 80% lower or something. And of course, it would be much faster because it's a much simpler and smaller part. But that allow you to do the cores, and not only would you do them in the, you know, like the exotic alloy we use now, but you could use whatever material you want, especially if you don't care about having the best performance or you don't care about being illegal or something like that. You could also produce the jacket with the Ghost Gunner, but it is more complicated and it will allow you to, or you will require you to buy more parts to do it. So we are really interested then in the other part of this turnkey solution is printing the polymer jackets with an SLA 3D printer, which is, I think, a very cool prospect. And between the two of those, it'll be really, really easy for you to make the core and the jacket yourself. And then you'll just bond them together in a way that we'll, you know, tell you about with some what is essentially a industrial strength super glue.
Cool.
And that's it. But you know, it doesn't require that. Like if you just had a mill or a lathe at home, you could do this stuff with that. Honestly, you could make the core on a drill press if you wanted to. You could always follow, you know, kind of the janky third world methods of producing.
Sure, sure.
You
yeah.
have to do it with the nice finished polished, you know, easy way.
And then once you have that, I assume, and I don't reload, but I assume that you would then just go essentially follow the standard procedure for reloading.
Yeah, that's right. And we'll tell you how much of which powder to use. We'll tell you how deep to load it in the case. So, you know, you'll still have all the information there that you need to know to reload it like you would, you know, anything that you might make at home.
Sure, sure. So, and I assume that once this is fully fleshed out and particularly once it's open sourced and everybody gets their hands on it, I'm sure that this sort of technology will be available in a variety of calibers. But what are you primarily developing for right now?
You know, it's hard to say. We always had kind of our general roadmap of the cartridges that we would develop in what order. But since coming out with this stuff, like I made a joke on Twitter, like if you give a mouse a cookie, he will instead demand a cookie in every like weird, obscure, obsolete, and like irrelevant caliber right. there is. So since we've come out with this demo video and people are just saying, you know, will you make it in 7.62 Tokarev? Will you make it in 7.62x39? Will you make it in like 9x25 Dillon? So everybody's got their pet cartridge that they want to make it in. Some of these, of course, excite me and the others involved in Atlas Arms more than others. So it remains to be seen, but I think essentially you could expect the next cartridge we develop after 9mm to either be a more powerful pistol cartridge like 10mm or like 357 SIG because that uses the same bullet, so we'd only have to develop a powder load. Or it would be probably like 5.56 so that we can, you know, get into the rifle stuff and prove to people that, you know, this isn't just about 9mm. This is a whole new design of bullet that can be applied to any cartridge.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's kind of what I was curious about, if you were going to get. I thought I'd seen that it was in development for 9, but if you were going to do 5.56 or 7.62 just to bridge
I
that
lost
gap.
You?
And, oh, can okay. you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you again. Sorry.
Oh, okay. I was just saying, yeah, I was curious to know. I saw that you were developing in 9, but bridging that gap over into more rifle side, I was curious to see if you guys were thinking about that. But the beautiful thing about open source is that once you do, it's kind of like throw it up there for 9, and you're like, all right, if you want it, develop it, post the files, and we've all got it at that point. But that's sweet. That'll pair really nicely with some of the stuff that's going on in the deterrent suspense world.
Definitely. And, you know, I hope that people will take this design and just kind of, you know, do it themselves and try to figure out how to, you know, adapt it to their own specific situation. But I would say, you know, like, I don't know how much of that is possible. I mean, working with the Ghost Gunner is kind of easier than developing a new type of ammunition the way we've done. And still, you know, that was supposed to be something that would open up this new manufacturing method to people and allow them to start tinkering with it with themselves. But we haven't seen actually a lot of third-party releases for the Ghost Gunner. People really are, unfortunately, in this kind of postmodern era, they want to buy stuff. And if it takes any effort to develop something new, it seems like they don't want to. But I do know that there are other guys in that whole world, kind of out of the printed gun community, that are starting to say, yeah, printed guns are great. They've been proven. Now what else can we do? And it'll be really cool if those guys kind of jump onto this and develop the more boutique loadings, like if they wanted in, 9x25 Dillon, they could do that or something.
Yeah, for sure. So what you had mentioned that over there at Atlas, you guys have a number of other projects. What else you got going on over there?
So, kind of the closest to being reality and the second priority as it is right now, in addition to like the Ghost Gunner lathe, which is sort of a spin-off project kind of separate from the Dagger development. But just, you know, separate from that stuff, we've got something that we call the ammo hose, to be named the Haley Hose tentatively, also based on, you know, an Atlas Shrugged character. And the idea here, in terms of common firearms these days, there are magazine fed firearms like the AR-15, Glocks, kind of most pistols and rifles that you would come across these days. And then you've got belt fed machine guns. So these feed from belts of linked ammo. So you've got like cartridges that are linked together with metal, like a metal chain. And that's how machine guns are usually fed. These belts have like 200 rounds of ammo at a time. But there's like that delinking mechanism that they have to use is very heavy. It's very complicated. It's very expensive to buy these guns. So the project is essentially, it's a hose that you can plug into your magazine-fed firearm, like a Glock or an AR-15, into the magazine well, and an electric motor in a hopper assembly feeds like 500 or 1,000 rounds of loose ammo through the hose and into the magazine port of the firearm, just like it would feed from a magazine. So essentially it converts a regular mag fed firearm to have belt fed capability. But I think at least in a more modular manner, in a way that is perhaps superior in its modularity and in, you know, removing that weight and complexity from the firearm and putting it somewhere else, like feeding from a backpack, for instance.
That's pretty wild. I'm trying to envision that. So there would be a magazine port, a hose would attach to that, and then that hose would be, you know, fed either into a backpack or even like a bucket below you that was full with. I assume there would need to be some organization to the ammo beneath in order to feed it into the hose correctly.
Yeah, there needs to be some, but essentially it's just feeding from a hopper. So it's not linked. It's not a belt configuration you would expect from a normal machine gun. I mean, you just like pour, you know, new ammo in the hopper and it'll feed as long as you give it ammo, essentially.
Right. Huh. That's wild. Do you guys, how, so that you said that's the closest thing that you've got that to becoming a reality?
Yeah. I mean, it's what we're like currently working with. So, we, you know, probably, you know, several months ago, I couldn't have even have told you that I knew for sure it was possible to do such a thing. But we've got an intern that came to stay with us for the summer. And since COVID happened, he just, you know, stayed with us and is doing his university work remotely. But he's been great at working on that project. And without him, we would still not be in the place we are now, knowing that it works, having a proof of concept. You know, it's not powered by a motor right now. It still has a hand crank on it. But we have verified that it is possible for this technology to work, and we are still making pretty good progress on proving it out and delivering something, kind of a minimum product that someone might want to print and make for themselves or might want to purchase from us in the future.
That's wild, man. That's wild that it's that close. So you've got a working model with a hand crank?
Yes, we do.
Damn, dude. Do you have like video posted of that by chance?
I think there was supposed to be video. There is video that exists. I don't think it's been made public, but I'm going to tap on the guy that took that video and maybe he wants to post it again.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. That'd be really cool to see. That sounds wild. I mean, the idea that you can just basically have something belt fed. I mean, When you're thinking about taking a step back and not just Atlas, but all of this that's going on, and you're thinking about what do things look like in 3 years? Like, what is going to be the capabilities that I have in my own home relatively easily? It's pretty wild.
It definitely makes me excited. That's for sure.
Oh yeah, hell yeah, dude. Yeah, it's just crazy. It's, I mean, the overall power that you're pushing down to the individual is crazy.
That's what we aim to do.
Good. So what else, what else you got going on over there?
So, I know you don't reload, but, for all your listeners that do, you know, that when, crap hits the fan, primers are the first thing to go. Primers, as it turns out, are the weak link in reloading, and that it doesn't matter that you can reload if, you know, when everyone's out of stock of the primers themselves. So that's kind of a really good frame for a project that, or a kind of concept that we've had for a couple of years in electrical ignition. So the idea is, instead of having a mechanical or like what would you call it? A chemo-mechanical igniter, mm-hmm. which is, you know, your striker or your hammer hits the primer, and that sets off a chemical reaction that ignites your powder charge. Where, like, in place of where that primer is in the cartridge, there would instead be what we call an arc primer. That is an insulated electrode that sparks an electrical arc, sparks an electrical spark between that electrode and the wall of the case, which would directly ignite the powder electronically. Right. So this is such a concept has been kind of tried before in other forms. Indirectly, other people use electrical resistors to ignite the powder, or they even have disposable primers that you have to load like regular primers that are electrically initiated, but this is a different system. You know, you put one of these primers in and you can reload that case like 20 times without popping this primer out. So it really gives you a long-term solution. If you've got 500 or 1,000 pieces of cases, you know, 500 or 1,000 cases with this arc primer in it, then you should be good for like the life of the gun, just reloading those 500 or 1,000 over and over. In addition, this comes with other benefits, like your trigger response is going to be much better because it's an electronic switch instead of like a mechanical sear and trigger and hammer system. Trouble with bullpups and the mushy triggers with those, that's completely eliminated. And there's some other technical advantages, but I probably won't get into it.
That's wild. That's pretty wild. I mean, I don't come from the reloading world, so I don't know how much that's been toyed around with before, but that's the first time I'm hearing of anything like that. That sounds like that's pretty interesting stuff, particularly that you can just reuse it. Yeah. That helps on a lot of different levels. Can I ask, were you a gun guy before you were a libertarian, or were you a libertarian before you were a gun guy, or both, or neither, or what?
I guess you could say I was. I mean, I grew up in a household that had firearms, a lot of firearms, actually, but we didn't actually go shooting that often. It was actually kind of my interest as an engineer in firearms. I mean, they're beautiful machines, and it's, some engineers marvel at aircraft. I mean, I do to a certain extent. Some marvel at cars, others at clockwork, and others at guns. And it's really that kind of fascination as an engineer that's driven my interest in firearms and shooting. I mean, yeah. So like, I like gun technology more than I even like shooting guns. And I think that's changed since, you know, I've had to become more of a gun guy to lead this project. And also as I have had engineering jobs where I've had the money to spend a lot on firearms and ammunition, or at least more than I did. But I think that it's kind of a happy accident that I should be interested in the technology separate from my interest in guns as a political instrument.
What brought you to the libertarian side of things in the first place?
I mean, it's hard to say. For me, it's been just kind of like an emergent or like an organic evolution. I've always been an individualist. I've always believed in liberalism as it might be classically defined in the West. I've always held in extremely high esteem the American founders, the forward thinkers, unprecedented liberal thinkers and Renaissance men that they were. And I guess you could say that kind of grew out as an extension of my culture in, you know, conservative America. In high school, I started to realize that like the ideals of liberty and liberalism were actually at odds with the conservative culture that I grew up in, or at least was around me. And I became more and more libertarian to the point where, you know, eventually I came to this coherent view where to become the most coherent with that belief in freedom and liberalism and individualism that I could be, I eventually had to dispense with the idea that the state is as the arbiter of morality and justice that our society believes it to be. And then, you know, it's just kind of becoming more coherent with my own beliefs. I became a quote unquote anarchist, you could say. But even that label, I don't think is very descriptive. I think that it's more descriptive to tell people I'm an individualist and I'm an anti-federalist. So there you go.
Cool. So was any of your move towards libertarianism influenced by outside actors, or was this kind of obviously it all was to a certain degree,
yeah.
But was there for instance, for me, it was Ron Paul in 2008 that released the floodgates, and sent me careening down that path. Was there anything like that for you, or was this just kind of slowly, you know, kind of, walking down the path of life and saying, you know, this doesn't quite jive with the things that I truly believe, and this doesn't quite drive. Oh, but this right here, this definitely jives. Is that?
I think it was more of the latter that you're talking about, more the just organic from within me. But, you know, nobody can deny the power of the Ron Paul moment of, you know, 2008, 2012. And that was, of course, like really big for me indirectly, I think, because you know, you do depend on the people around you, the people in your life to help form, you know, to bounce ideas off of and to form your beliefs and your convictions. So, of course, in high school in 2008 and then college in 2012, I was kind of surrounded by a few friends who are really big in the Ron Paul movement, who I think were kind of woken up in their politics by Ron Paul specifically. And those people went on, and though I don't, you know, they're probably the best example of those friends of mine is he would now consider himself like a left libertarian. Definitely like a lot more concerned with like social justice and like thick libertarianism than I am. But having those friends to kind of like challenge my ideas and bounce ideas off of, that was definitely formative. And then I would also say the last thing keeping me from being, you know, taking that final leap into total freedom, the last thing that kept me kind of believing it, that the government was necessary, was as an engineer, as an inventor, somebody who creation and innovation is very important to, I thought, like, of course we have to have the government enforce intellectual property rights, because else nobody would be allowed to make a living with what they created. And, you know, I really bought into all that kind of propaganda that, you know, people take for granted. And then I started a company, my first company, 2020 Armor, right out of university, even while I was still in university. I helped write the patent for that. And through the whole course of that, I realized, you know, this whole intellectual property thing, it's all stupid. It's all arbitrary. It's all fake. This isn't real. And I'll tell you exactly who the people that would innovate in the absence of intellectual property monopolies is me. The most innovative people in our society are the people that are going to do it without the government granting them a special monopoly on it. And you can see that in Atlas Arms, right? Like the commercial industry didn't make this superior ammunition. It took people doing it for free that actually have the passion to do it, not the people trying to restrict access just so they can make a profit. And that was, you know, for me, that was the last straw. And when that broke, then the term anarchist finally did apply to myself and my ideology.
Yeah, it's so cool that all of this open source and peer to peer, just the entire, probably the last decade has been so crazy with it, particularly the last 5 years. And it has absolutely nailed the coffin shut on the idea that you need, a mafia enforcing intellectual property laws in order for innovators to step forth and create. Like it's just absolutely killed that argument. There is no question that the most exciting spaces, at least to me, the most exciting spaces.
Jim.
What's that?
I said it's dead, Jim.
It's dead, Jim. Yeah. Yeah. It's the most exciting spaces to me. And part of it is because it's inherently part of my interest. But the other part is that I genuinely think there is no faster growing, more insane space to be right now than things like Bitcoin and 3D printed arms and home making guns and ammo and stuff like that. It's just, there just isn't, it's going along. I feel like I have somebody on the last time I had, let's see. So this year, since 2020 started, I've had Lee, you know, Enbloc Press on twice and now you, and the first time he came on was to introduce the FGC9. And the second time he came on, well, I mean, it wasn't just for these reasons, but just as reasonable benchmarks. The second time he came on was to talk about the FGC 9 Mark II, which I guess is out completely now. And now you're on here talking about creating your own armor piercing ammo. It's like that's all been within this year. And I know that that took a lot of work to lead up to. But as with each additional person that gloms onto the movement and starts contributing, it's like, it just dumps gas on the fire, and things have just started to move faster and faster and faster and faster. And it's just crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
Yeah, it is. And there's something I want to touch on. Like, I know this might not be apparent for people that aren't themselves kind of technically minded like I am. But you know, like 3D printed gun stuff, honestly, it hasn't been, I mean, it's been politically interesting. It has not been technically interesting until very recently. And, you know, cause like this isn't, I mean, there's like the gun tech itself, which is forever old. The AR-15 is like 65 years old. It's right. Boring.
Yeah.
just to like print it, you know, that's like politically interesting. It's very important for us. And I definitely applaud that. But it is just like a new way to manufacture the same old thing. But that's not what 3D printed guns, that's not where the story ends, right? It's not, and we get to this like, and this is very new, new term, this militia industrial complex, that we're not just creating, you know, we're not just making the same old stuff, but this is a parallel industry to the commercial gun industry or the military industrial complex, where it's not just the same old stuff, but we're actually making things better. And a prime example of that, Atlas Arms, kind of, you know, we are focused on stuff that's really expensive, very difficult to develop, you know, whole new technologies, as far reaching as we can be. And of course, we're making like the Dagny Dagger. This is not just legal. We're not just making it like so that you can make it yourself. We're making it much better than traditional APMO. And another place you see this is in the electrochemical machined barrel that's on the FGC9, for instance. It's not, it isn't just a barrel you can make yourself, but in fact, you can use better steels, stronger steels for that. And you can make a better gun barrel that can take much more pressure and can fire much more powerful cartridges with that than you otherwise could if you just bought a barrel at the store. I think it's worth saying, because only yesterday did Ivan the Troll introduce us to the ballistic results of his what's called a progressive rifled barrel, where it's not just the same, the rifling doesn't have the same twist rate all the way through it, but it kind of gently accelerates the twist on the bullet. And he's getting 100 FPS, he's getting a 10% increase in velocity using that barrel than a traditionally rifled barrel. And of course, again, you can't just go buy this progressively rifled barrel at a store. It's something where you have to make it yourself. So not only, you know, can you make this technology yourself, but it's better than what you could already buy.
Yes. Yeah. It's crazy. Not only that, and I was talking about this with Lee the other day. And this definitely takes a backseat to creating new stuff that you can't commercially buy, like a progressively different twist rate or whatever in the rifling. There's stuff that you cannot buy right now because that's the political state of affairs. You just can't get it. It is very difficult to get ammunition right now. It is very difficult to get firearms right now. It's not impossible, but it's difficult. And having the ability to make them yourself doesn't just alleviate and particularly here in the US, I'm in Texas. Like I don't fear anytime soon a situation where I can't legally purchase firearms or legally obtain firearms, but I do fear times where because of supply and demand, I can't get them. And because of political pressures that force demand to outstrip supply, I do fear that. And bringing a lot of the capabilities into your home, even if you say, well, I can purchase far superior ammunition and rifles in times of peace and all of that. Well, if shit hits the fan, it's nice to be able to have that in your home and be able to do it yourself. But I do want to get back to, because I saw Ivan post that, and I'm just not in this world enough to know all of the implications of that. So do you think you could explain to me and the listeners what exactly Ivan did, why it's really cool, you know, and just go off on a tangent for a while?
Okay. Yeah, sure. So, the rifling in a gun barrel is, there are grooves on the inside of the bore, they're fairly shallow. But they are in a twist pattern. So like for a 9mm, that's usually, they make one rotation of twist per 10 inches of barrel length. So the whole point of that is to gently coax that bullet to spin. So that by the time it exits the barrel, the barrel is spinning very rapidly because, of course, it's you know, moving very fast linearly, being shot out. And that spin gives it gyroscopic stability. So, you know, there are different ways to be stabilized. This is kind of a lesson in aerospace engineering, kind of. But due to the physics of a rotating body having angular momentum that is conserved, it makes it much more difficult for turbulence in the air or wind or, you know, whatever other forces to shove the bullet off track. And so you can think of it as rifling keeps a bullet accurate and on target very precisely. You've always been able to kind of make at home a smoothbore barrel very easily. But only recently have you been able to make a really nice barrel very cheaply. And that's done through electrochemical machining, which was kind of brought into the DIY community by Jeff Rodriguez and then kind of perfected in practicality by Ivan the Troll. And this idea is that you 3D print a little jig that holds a copper wire, and then you run an electric current through that wire in salt water, and it causes controlled corrosion on the inside of the barrel in the shape of that rifling. So you can you essentially just corrode away the material until you're left with those rifling grooves to make the bullet more stable.
Can I stop you for a moment?
Yes.
How do you direct the rifling the corrosion to create the exact rifling pattern that you want?
Yeah, so you can look this up. I think Ivan published it under Project But What About Rifling or What About Barrels or something like that. You can find that on the Deterrence Dispensed LBRY. And it'll explain that in detail, but essentially you have a 3D printed jig that has that, that twist in it. And then that, copper wire is just shoved into the grooves on that 3D printed jig.
Oh, okay. So you're basically, if I'm understanding this correctly, and this is really dumbed down, but you're wrapping the copper wire around the jig, putting that in the barrel and then running current through it.
Yeah. That's okay. Accurate to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So this new thing, I mean, typically, again, for complicated technical reasons, it's been pretty difficult for traditional gun companies to make progressively rifled barrels. But what Ivan can do, because again, this is using a 3D printed jig and then corroding the rifling into it, is he can print a plastic jig to hold the copper electrode that starts out with a very, very gentle twist, and then that twist becomes more aggressive. So then, as the bullet is going into the barrel, instead of going from zero twist to max twist, the way it does in a regular barrel, it's kind of much more gently accelerating that projectile to rotate or to spin. And of course that results in like much less losses to like friction and vibration. And again, you know, it's kind of complex, but you can kind of see where to do that gently rather than violently to the bullet allows it to keep more of that ballistic energy. And you don't get the inefficiency that you do when you jump straight to the 1 in 10 twist that 9mm barrel has at the muzzle. So that shows up, you know, when you don't have that inefficiency, when it is more efficient, that shows up as extra velocity for the same cartridge. That same cartridge you put in this barrel, it gives you 100 FPS, 10% more velocity than a standard rifle barrel.
Yeah, that's wild. That's wild. Do you think there is anything to... So in a traditional rifled barrel, it is the same twist rate beginning pretty much right in front of the bullet all the way through to the end of the barrel. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. So you can see, you know, the throat, and I'm using ballistics terms here, so sorry for that, but the short distance called the throat that the bullet jumps between when it's in the cartridge to when it engages with the rifling, You know, that's like less than a tenth of an inch. I mean, much less than a tenth of an inch. Usually like a hundredth of an inch. So, you know, you could see we're going from zero twist to max twist in that hundredth of an inch or whatever is very violent. And that's where you get so much loss in efficiency. But, you know, if you gently accelerate to that twist rate, down, you know, through the entire length of the barrel, whether it's 4 inches or 10 inches or whatever, you can see how that would be much, much more desirable.
Sure. Sure. The other aspect of this too, and I don't know what effect this has or if I'm right or wrong about it, but theoretically in my mind, I would be thinking, if the barrel is long enough in a traditionally rifled barrel, the last X amount of that of travel would be at the same rotational velocity. The bullet would have the same rotational velocity through the last X inches of the barrel and then into the air. Whereas this, the rotational velocity is actually increasing and increasing as it exits the barrel. I mean, am I right or wrong about that? And then B, does that have any effect on the ballistic like pattern?
Well, again, I'm sorry to say, like, it's kind of a technical matter. So
okay. The
twist rate does change because the velocity is changing. But, you know, it doesn't, as far as what the bullet sees, it, you know, in terms of accuracy, it doesn't matter after you've left the barrel. So it's all about what happens in the barrel.
Sure.
And, you know, so like, yeah, you can achieve more aggressive twist rates if you kind of, you know, ramp up to them gently as you go through the barrel. And that could be a benefit to other cartridges also. But, you know, most of the gains, most of the benefits to be seen in this case is just because you can start slow with the rotation and end up fast with the rotation.
Yeah. What firearm did he use to demonstrate that?
The FGC-9.
Oh, wow.
What else?
Yeah, cool. Very cool. Very cool. Man, I wonder what effect that would have on much longer barreled firearms.
Yeah, it would be. You should see even better.
That's what I would think.
So
yeah, especially because you could much more gradually ramp up. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so just to go back, that product essentially is not available commercially or for retail, and now because of Ivan and a lot of other supporters and in that community. Well, it's not available for purchase necessarily, but it's available to be made, by you, which is absolutely incredible. Second order effect of this whole thing is like you said, not just are we making things that already were possible for you in your home, where people are actively creating new, maybe the idea is not new, but bringing it to life in a way that is obtainable for retail users, which is just incredible.
Yeah. Like if you had access to the entire arsenal of the United States military and of all the police departments around this country, you still might not find pistols go, as far as submachine guns go, you know, in the way that it relates to this technology, you still wouldn't find technology of this superior quality, with them. So, very exciting.
Crazy, man. Crazy. Well, I tell you what, I don't want to run too long. We're hanging around just under an hour. So, do you have any other thoughts or ideas that you want to add before we wrap it up? And then obviously I want to ask for all your plugs and stuff like that, but this has been awesome. And what I've been doing is just, I've been checking in with guys, like I said, with like Lee and them, just kind of every now and then. So, you know, you're always welcome to come back on and give us an update or tell us about some new stuff that you're doing or anything. So with that in mind, you got anything else and then plugs?
Not really anything else. I mean, I guess my big mission, my big, like message these days is that the militia industrial complex is real. It's happening. You don't have to be bound to the way things have been. You don't have to be bound to, you know, massive corporations. You know, the sum of human knowledge is now available to you over the internet on like Wikipedia. And you don't have to let talking heads and administrators run your life. Do your own thing. The world is your oyster. And, you know, join us, be part of us, be inspired by us, help us. And we want to help other people. So everybody out there that's interested in guns, that understands how ridiculous it is that we all carry AR-15s that are from like 65 years ago, you know, help us out. I'm the only one in this community really that does this full time. Everybody else, you know, has their normal jobs, does this as a hobby, and we're all here to help you. Join us, look us up, talk to us, get involved. I guess that's my message for today. As far as the plugs go, you can follow kind of the day-to-day or incidental stuff we have to say on Twitter. Our handle is @atlas_arms_org. But I'm sure you can find us just from doing a search. Visit our website. That's atlasarms.org. You can find out more about the company, more about us main contributors to the project. And even see one of the other projects that we've been working on to publish information open source. And of course, learn more about the Dagger there as well. From there, you will be linked. You can link to our crowdfunding site hosted on gundynamics.com, which is a crowdfunding site just for firearms projects. We are nearing reaching our goal, which is a great thing. Again, we are a nonprofit, registered 501c3. Before we sell anything, we want to give everything we do back to the public. So it's very important that we have your donation so that we continue to work as fast and deliver this project as fast as possible. And then also from our website, you can be linked to a Bitcoin page on our website. Where you can donate by Samurai Wallet Paynims if you're really privacy conscious, or by BTC Pay. And then lastly, if you would like to, reach out to the company at dagny@atlasarms.org, or I should say me personally if you'd like, austin@atlasarms.org. Things have been very busy for us as we've released this demo video. We're doing a lot of administrative and publicity stuff these days. It might take us some time to answer your email. And of course, we can't wait to go back to the technical development. But there you go. We're open. Contact us if you'd like.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks a bunch for coming on, and we'll check in with you here in the next couple of months and see what else you guys got cooking up over there. So thanks everyone for listening. We'll catch you next time.